The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. Today, Paul Dixon returns to the program. His latest book is Contraband Cocktails, How America Drank When It Wasn't Supposed to. Welcome back to the program, Paul.
Thank you, Vic.
Paul, I remember a few years ago you put out a book called Drunk. This is one of those subjects that you enjoy, isn't it?
Well, I do them for different reasons. I mean, the Drunk book was really... I mean, the basis for that was wanting to get in the Guinness Book of World Records. It had nothing to do with drunk, but I had to find... I was infatuated with the idea of that I could get in the Guinness Book. And my kids were much younger, and I wanted to get in there. I at that point, you had to push a peanut across Iowa with your nose or eat a bicycle or something. So I went for language, and I found that nobody had ever claimed the title of largest list of synonyms. So... And I looked at various different bodily functions and other things and found out that the most synonymed word in the English language was for drunk. And so that got me to that. And this one came from my lifelong fascination with Prohibition and what we did to ourselves during Prohibition, how many other ills we brought in because we had Prohibition.
And Prohibition became a period where cocktails really became in vogue, didn't they? What's the difference between a cocktail and a mixed drink, Paul?
It's usually a third ingredient. Even on higher-end restaurants back up through the 50s and 60s had separate lists for mixed drinks and cocktails. Cocktails usually involved bitters or something like triple sec or Pernod, but it would be some third ingredient rather than just scotch and soda would be a mixed drink, or even a gin and tonic would be a mixed drink, because you're just putting two things. But it was using something else to give it a certain flavor and a certain feel that was good with cocktails. So a martini really needed vermouth, and a Manhattan really needed sweet vermouth and bourbon and all the rest of it. So it was that concocting, and it usually went. The drink was served without ice. It was used a shaker, a cocktail shaker, and it was usually meant to be a sort of an elegant alternative to just slugging down a shot of whiskey or drinking, just mixing, two ingredients together.
I'd say it's a safe bet, Paul, that the majority of our listeners were not around during Prohibition. Why don't you tell them what Prohibition was and how it came about?
Well, Prohibition was a fascinating thing in American history because it started about the turn of the century. This great big push by various people to get liquor made illegal, wine, beer, and full-scale liquor. And what happened was really a group of two different forces got together. One was the suffragettes were very much in favor of Prohibition. The belief of the suffragettes was that it was making men less able, making them more likely to be abusers, all that, the business that men were not working as hard. So the suffragettes and the people, the religious groups who believed that it was sinful to drink, banded together, and they started pushing for it. One of the things they realized was if they got Prohibition established, that it would cause the government to go bankrupt, because the government's main source of income, going back to its earliest days, to the Whiskey Rebellion and the early taxation on liquor, was that the government was surviving because of A, tariffs, but B, and more importantly, tax on liquor. That was what was funding the country. And they had to get through. So in order to get Prohibition through, they had to get the income tax through. So once they got the income tax through, they really made hay, and it was passed, and it was finally They got the majority of the states to ratify it as an amendment to the Constitution. It wasn't just a piece of legislation. It was an amendment to the Constitution. And in January of 1920, it all went into effect, and it was now illegal. And it's, you know, tens of thousands of beer gardens and clubs where they were served liquor, and fine restaurants, and low down bars and everything else closed their door. Manufacturers stopped making liquor, started producing wine, stopped producing beer, and all of these things came to a halt in 1920. And what happened almost immediately, though, was a new culture arrived. With people learned how to make gin in their bathtubs, and people knew how to learned how to get liquor from offshore. It was coming in through rum runners, and it was coming down from Canada and up from Mexico. And there were all sorts of ways to which liquor was coming into the country. So there gradually, over the course of the 20s, there were more, in most cities, there were more, the more illegal speakeasies and something called a blind pig, which is really lower down than a speakeasy, and nightclubs and supper clubs, all just flourished. And in many places, the law just looked the other way. In the other places, it was so overwhelming, the interest in having these clubs, that they couldn't arrest enough people. They couldn't close enough places down. And with it came this huge culture, which was much more sophisticated, of cocktails, of cocktail parties. People felt it was almost their patriotic duty to drink, just to show how absurd this law was. And with it came this fascination for drinking and a culture. Now, if you look at the culture, the Thin Man movies and the Thin Man books, you look at The Great Gatsby, which is really a novel about a bootlegger. You look at the literature of the 20s, you look at the music, the nightclubs that spawn the crooners and the songbirds, and all of these things come out of these nightclubs. These nightclubs are almost all really speakeasies, but they're big entertainment. Places like Harlem, parts of Chicago, big entertainment was there in these nightclubs. Some of them you'd bring your own booze. Some of them they actually would just sell the booze right there. And so what happened was, in place of sort of the old-time saloon, you ended up with a new kind of a world of nightclubs with its own culture and its own sophistication. And movies were made. There were many movies made during the 20s when it was illegal, which glorified drinking, which glorified the nightclubs, the singers and the dancers and the Cotton Club in Harlem. And it almost helped literature grow because people like Fitzgerald and Hemingway and the rest of them were fascinated by it. John Dos Passos. And many of the writers themselves, at the end of Prohibition, I do this in the book, they invented their own drinks almost to make fun of the whole thing. I mean, Sinclair Lewis had a Main Street after his novel. The drink was called a Main Street. He said, if you have two of these, you can't walk down Main Street. Mm-hmm. Theodore Dreiser actually invented a drink, a cocktail, called an American Tragedy.
Uh-huh. After his book. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I always wanted to write about this. I always was fascinated by the deep, deep paradox that what the Prohibition created was this culture of the cocktail and the cocktail party and the nightclub and the crooners and all this other stuff, and of course it enhanced, it allowed crime to increase. I mean, the great criminal forces in this country got their leg up with Prohibition and made them all rich men, and they got tremendous power during that period. And the rum runners themselves were extraordinarily well organized. In fact, these ships that worked offshore, they would manufacture liquor or get it from boats coming in from Scotland and Ireland and other places, and they would run these mammoth factory ships offshore beyond the limit where the Coast Guard could go. They had their own presses to print labels on these ships, and they had a code that was so difficult to break that when the government finally breaks their code, the rum runners were actually using a secret code, that when World War II came along, the government was ready to break the Japanese code because they knew how to break code. These were very sophisticated operations. Mm. And I just got fascinated with the whole period. And what started me on it all, Vic, was I picked up years ago in a flea market in Florida, I picked up this little tiny typewritten book of drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy at the flea market said it was from Prohibition when selling drink books or mixology books was illegal. He said, why don't you, this was one that somebody typed out, that you can see the little, would you put your fingers over, you can feel the raised letters and where the period digs into the pages, hand-typed book of cocktail recipes. And I found out later that the belief was that you could be arrested for owning a cocktail manual. So none were published. No publishers until the very end of Prohibition would even dare to publish a book of cocktail recipes. And people were afraid they were getting arrested for owning a flask, a pot, or a cocktail shaker, or anything having to do with cocktails or drinking would, in certain states and certain places, you could get arrested for violating the law. So I got fascinated with the fact that people had to carry this culture of these drinks and how to make them, and some of them were quite elaborate, through typewritten, things they passed along to each other, or things they slipped into a book and typed out. Or, people, since this book has come out a couple weeks ago, I've had two people report that in their family they had a recipe for bathtub gin.
Mm-hmm.
And that was passed down.
Paul Dixon joins us. The book is Contraband Cocktails, How America Drank When It Wasn't Supposed To. And I learned a lot from this book. I didn't realize that before Prohibition, saloons were mostly a place where men gathered. But once we had these speakeasies and it was illegal to drink, it seemed to create equality between the sexes. The women were filling these places, and this book is filled with recipes for martinis and various cocktails, and I noticed that it's pocket size. You could carry it in your back pocket and have these recipes handy. And I also learned about the man with the green hat. Tell us about him. This is a wonderful anecdote.
Yeah, I mean, the man in the green hat was this character. His name was Cassidy. He was a World War I vet. And he had gone, he had been working for the Pennsylvania Railroad, and he was drafted and went into the war and came back from overseas, from the battlefront, and had been wounded in warfare, and he couldn't get his job back. And he lived on Capitol Hill in Washington. He'd been born in West Virginia, and his name was George Cassidy. He was from West Virginia. His family were teetotalers. They were fundamentalist people who didn't believe the drinking. But in Europe, when he'd been over there fighting for the United States, he had drinking was common among the soldiers, and they drank cognac. And when they were together with French troops, they broke open bottles of wine and such. And when Cassidy's coming back on a troop ship, the word comes out that they've just passed Prohibition. That he's coming back from Europe, and the soldiers on the ship, the GIs, the dog faces, whatever they were, doughboys, were all convinced that it was a punishment for them. They were afraid they were going to come back and do a lot of drinking, and they were quite the military was almost unanimously against the fact that they were going to prevent drinking. So Cassidy got back. He couldn't get his job back. He had several children. He lived a couple blocks from Congress, and a congressman who he knew as a friend told him one night, he said to this congressman, I'm going crazy. I can't get a job because of my injuries. They won't take me back. The railroad wouldn't hire me back. And there were no provisions in those days to ensure these guys got their jobs back. And they said, why don't you, we have a great need on the Hill for Capitol Hill for booze. And we need somebody to go to New York and pick up, bottles of scotch and different things and bring it down and sell it. So we set up this elaborate book bootlegging operation in the buildings, in the House office buildings, and in the Senate office building. He had more keys to more congressmen's offices, so his business flourished among the very people who had actually created Prohibition, the actual legislators who had voted for it. He's now their personal bootlegger. And he finally gets caught, President Hoover and J. Edgar Hoover, who was just beginning with the FBI at that time. They were really after him, and they could never catch him. But they did spot him one time, and he was wearing a green fedora. So he became known as the man in the green hat. And when they finally arrested him and got him sentenced him, he went public. He did a series of articles about how he had created this mammoth business for himself inside the halls of Congress. And Congress at that time was totally corrupt. In fact, one congressman went to jail for slavery. He had taken people out of a jail in Prince George's County, just outside of Washington, and had them working on his own private still to manufacture liquor. This was a member of Congress. One member of Congress was shot during a fight with a bootlegger. So it was in the midst of this tremendous corruption and hypocrisy that he flourished. And he became, to a lot of people, he became sort of a Robin Hood. He got booze for constituents who'd come to town, and he had a large operation. The whole area in Washington was just loaded with speakeasies, and some of them quite elegant. There was one called the Mayflower Club, which operated blocks from the White House, and it was this mammoth nightclub with musicians, and the walls had huge murals on them of famous world leaders. It had Mahatma Gandhi playing the clarinet, and it had Lloyd George playing the drums, and, you know, on the walls in these murals. They were sophisticated places. But the man in the green hat, Cassidy, went to jail. He came out of jail. He became a well-known man. He was the head of the Irish-American War Veterans. In fact, he was one of the first people to draw a lottery number when they were starting the lottery in 1940, prior to World War II. But again, I use him as the central hero of the book because he sort of represented the hypocrisy of it all. You know, the only way this disabled veteran could get work was violating the law for people who made the law. It was just so saturated with irony that I couldn't resist doing him. And he was a friendly guy, and people loved him. And, you know, in fact, when they sent him to jail, the jailers the people who kept the jail, the guards and the other people there, were mostly World War I vets, and so they let him go home at night. His jail sentence was—he served it from 9 to 5, and because they just couldn't bear to keep him overnight. He was too nice a fellow.
Paul Dixon joins us. His book is Contraband Cocktails: How America Drank When It Wasn't Supposed to, and you have all these drink recipes in here, and many of them have what you call the cultural context. And this is so fun to read because you have so many different anecdotes. And one of my favorites involves our last president from Ohio, Warren Gamaliel Harding, who was particularly fond of a mixed drink, a cocktail called a Sazerac, which I had not heard of. But this is a great story. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I mean, he was not one of our most I'll put it the other way. I remember reading one noted historian, they said one of the great strengths of America, the great proof that American democracy works, is that the country survived the administration of Warren G. Harding. So there was a lot of corruption surrounding his administration, Teapot Dome and other things. But he went right between the time he's elected and the time he takes office. He goes down to New Orleans to take a tour to South America, and he goes into a bar illegally, but he gets a drink called a Sazerac. He decides it's the best thing he's ever tasted, and the bartender in this speakeasy makes up thermoses filled with Sazeracs, which he takes on him on this cruise of South America. And then when he comes back, he invites the bartender to come to his inauguration so he could make Sazeracs in the White House. So this was in the midst of Prohibition. This was going on. And, of course, the culture itself at that time were flappers and jazz. I mean, all these other things are happening at the same time. So you've got this very handsome, colorful, but corrupt president who's a boozer. And you've got the country suffering under prohibition, but at the same time, all this music and this gaiety and this and new literature. And I mean, if you look at the middle of prohibition, 1925, that's the Great Gatsby, that's the Wasteland, that's John Dos Passos. But one of Dos Passos' great books. If you go down this list of books that were coming out of this culture, coming out of this time.
Mm-hmm.
I said one of the ironies in the book, I found that a lot of people who you don't expect to find, like James Beard, the great chef, he tells a story in his own autobiography about when he was a young man, he made bathtub gin for the people in the neighborhood. He learned how to make bathtub gin, and it's called bathtub gin not because you mixed it in a bathtub, but you needed to put it in a gallon jug to create the gin. And the only place where the spigot was high enough was usually on the bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you'd finish it off. But Beard said he made very good illegal gin in his time.
Prohibition ended finally during the first term of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And FDR was fond of his dirty martinis. He even served one to Stalin.
Yeah, and he also served one to Babe Ruth.
I love it.
Who had been used to drinking, you know, oceans of beer, and all of a sudden he gives one. No, he brought one with Stalin, and the dirty martini is just, and it sounds like something fairly obscene, but all it means is dripping some of the olive juice out of the jar into the martini to give it a little more flavor.
The brine, and I like these ones where they would coat the glass with vermouth and then pour it out. What do they call that one?
Oh, that was a martini, but it was a
particular way to make it. Right. Well, Paul, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that you have written an awful lot of books, and you've written about a lot of things. We've had you on the program a number of times. I think one of my favorite interviews with you was for the Dixon Baseball Dictionary. Wow. And as we get into the back of this book, you've got a glossary of terms, and I knew that I could get this from you. And one of them is Methodist Hellenium. And this made me think of my sainted maternal grandmother, because she was a Methodist. She was a member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and she was proud of the fact that she'd never had a drink in her life. And late in life, she's becoming kind of forgetful, as some older people do. And she couldn't really – her short-term memory was kind of shot, and she couldn't really remember stuff that happened a long time ago. And one time she came out in the kitchen, and they were pouring some champagne discreetly, and she thought it was cider. And she took a sip of it, and she absolutely loved it. And suddenly she could remember everything.
Well, we don't want an advertisement for booze, but it was – that's a great story.
She was a wonderful woman.
Yeah.
Ethel. Yeah.
You could invent a drink, invent a cocktail after it, call it the Ethel.
Well, it's very confusing to me as a little boy, because we would pull in the gas station and my father would say, fill it up with Ethel. And I'd look around to see, where's Grandma?
Yeah.
You remember where they called it that, Paul?
Wasn't that an additive?
I don't know, but my dad used to say, fill it up with Ethel. So I guess maybe it was. But we digress. Are you still working on that Leo DeRocher book, Paul? Can we talk about that?
Sure. I just submitted the final manuscript, which means it goes through editing and stuff, and it'll be ready for the spring of 2017. It's going to be a big book, I think. I don't think I've ever had so much fun doing a book, because I kept finding things that were just... I would sit there and I would just laugh when I'd find these things. I'd find these associations between, you know, DeRocher and Truman Capote, or DeRocher and Batista, or DeRocher and all these different major characters in the world, Spencer Tracy and Frank Sinatra. And this is outside the baseball. I'm just talking about the people, the early fights he had with Casey Stengel. So it's loaded with baseball stuff. And DeRocher played for all the great – he played for the Murderers Row Yankees as a shortstop. He played for the Gas House Gang, St. Louis Cardinals. He played for the Dodgers and then went on to become a manager. He's one of the greatest shortstops of history in his own as a player. And then he became probably one of the most famous managers of all time. And filled with controversy, married movie star – Lorraine Day, and very much involved with gambling. He was suspended from baseball. Many of your listeners will remember him as the character in the Jackie Robinson 1947, where he shows up as Leo DeRocher. He's the one that brings the team to heel on DeRocher, tells them that they've got to accept DeRocher. But he was very coarse, very interesting, very colorful. And phenomenally interesting friends. I mean, his lifelong best friend is Frank Sinatra. Mm. He's taking calls from when he's managing the Cubs later in his life. He manages the Giants, New York, manages the Cubs, manages the Dodgers, goes on to manage the Astros late in life. But he, when he was with the Cubs, he'd take calls in the dugout from Dean Martin. He kept Spencer Tracy from going overseas because Tracy was his good luck charm. I mean, the thing about the book is it's sort of an American, it's a biography of a very combative, interesting guy in the mid-century America that becomes not only is a big baseball book, because some of the baseball scenes are extraordinary, really extraordinary baseball scenes. And, of course, he was very argumentative, both as a player and as a manager, but you've got the great baseball teams, but you've got this other world out there, a Broadway of Hollywood, of Chicago, and all that goes with it. So I just don't think I've ever had so much fun with a character, because I'd done Bill Veeck before, Bill Veeck, the famous owner, who is very colorful but very lovable. And the subtitle of my DeRocher book is Baseball's Most Hated Man. I mean, he was really controversial, but very, very interesting.
We had you on for the Bill Veeck biography, and that is another fabulous baseball book, Paul. And I'm really looking forward to reading about Leo DeRocher. And it's always a pleasure to have you on the program, Paul. We're running out of time, and so I just want to thank you again for all your work on all these different things. And we call Paul Dixon the Vesuvius of books, and there's a good reason for that. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Vic. I really appreciate it.
Our guest has been Paul Dixon. His book is Contraband Cocktails, How America Drank When It Wasn't Supposed To. And when you read it and you look at the recipe for the martini, you'll see a wonderful quote from Dorothy Parker that we can't say on the radio. But when you read it, I'm sure you'll chuckle. Thanks again, Paul.
Thanks, Vic.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes.